Good afternoon. We will call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order on this March 1, 2012 afternoon. The record should reflect it's approximately 3:36 p.m. And we do have with us a quorum present immediately to my left, co-chair Senator Wagner, Senator Stedman, Senator French, Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Senator Paskvan. I do expect that we'll soon be joined by other members, but and I understand Senator French has a committee obligation that may take him away for a short while, but anyway, we're at that busy time when there are some potential for conflicts in schedule. But during this hearing, we are pleased to be joined by BP and ConocoPhillips, who will offer comments on the committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 relating to the oil and gas production tax rates. Listening audience, especially that's watching on the TV, should understand that we've also received from ExxonMobil, Pioneer Natural Resources, and the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation letters in the last couple of days. In other words, people can submit by letters their positions on this bill. And those letters have been distributed to the committee members, and they are posted on BASIS. So all this information is available to anyone that wants to access BASIS. For the record, approximately 140 Alaskans offered public testimony to the Resources Committee on Tuesday and Wednesday of this week. We very much appreciate the input and the thoughts of each and every Alaskan who has participated in that process. Additionally, each of us have received dozens of emails from around the state. In fact, we have been communicating, many of us, with Alaskans about the oil tax issue almost daily for the last year. Today I gathered all the email messages that my office has received over the last week, and we've distributed those to the committee members. And they will be part of the permanent record of this Senate bill. Again, the committee welcomes and appreciates the thoughts of every person that has participated, and certainly the people that have appeared here in Juneau and presented testimony to us. Before we get started with the direct testimony, I believe it's appropriate to briefly summarize the committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 in case there are people that are tuning in for the first time and trying to understand a little bit more about what is before the committee. So I think it's important for the public to understand part of the what we are discussing. First of all, the committee substitute for Senate Bill 192, it preserves the deductions for the capital expenditures and the operating expenditures and the transportation costs. So that component, you know, there are many people have heard the term levers. There are many levers in our tax system. This committee substitute preserves the deductions for capital expenditures, operating expenditures, and transportation costs. It preserves the tax credits that go with, for example, capital expenditures. It preserves the state of Alaska's royalty rate. It preserves royalty modification. And most importantly, it reduces progressivity from the current tax structure, and it does that in two ways. It reduces the slope of progressivity, and it lowers the cap on progressivity. With respect to specifically how does it preserve or what are the tax credits that it preserves, there are a number of credits that are applicable or levers that are part of the system. Those include capital expenditure credits, which are approximately a 20% credit to the bottom line. Those are preserved. There's alternative tax credits on oil and gas exploration. Those credits are preserved. There is a net operating loss. People may have heard about NOLs. Those carry forward credits are preserved. There's a transitional investment expenditure credits. Those are preserved. The well lease expenditure credits, those are preserved. The Cook Inlet jackup rig credit, that is preserved as well. With respect to Alaska's not changing its royalty rate, Senate Bill 192 preserves Alaska's low royalty rate. Alaska, as a owner of a world-class resource, collects approximately 12.5% to 16.5% as a royalty. comparison states, for example, Texas or North Dakota, while they are on private lands. For example, in Texas, we've heard testimony that the average is assumed to be about a 25% royalty rate. North Dakota, also where the majority of the land is on private land, most of the production most of the royalty is at approximately 20% in that range. Again, with respect to preserving royalty modification, under certain circumstances, the commissioner can modify royalty. If a field or pool is not in production, that pool must be sufficiently delineated, proven to be not otherwise economically feasible, and the commissioner may reduce the royalty to 5%, but never lower than 5%. If a royalty modification is submitted to prolong the economic life of a field, for example, as costs increase or a price decreases, the commissioner is allowed to reduce the royalty, but never below 3% royalty. And also the same type of standard is if one needs to reestablish production, royalty can be reduced, but never lower than 3%. Setting forth specifically the lower progressivity, Alaska has a system by which taxable barrels are analyzed after royalty is, so to speak, taken off the top. And then from there, there is a deduction of the transportation costs, operating expenditures, and capital expenditures. So if the public hears the term PTV, which stands for production tax value, that is the value that is established after one arrives at taxable barrels and after the deduction of transportation, operating expenditures, and capital expenditures. The original trigger of $30 in production tax value is maintained, but it's at that point moving up the price or PTV value that the rate or the slope is changed from 0.4 to 0.35, and the second trigger is it is reduced at 50% from that 0.35 to a 0.1 progressivity, and also there is a statutory maximum rate at 60%, which is a reduction from the current 75%. So I thought that that would be an important, just generally laying out the framework, some of the levers that exist in Alaska, so that the viewing audience would potentially be brought up to speed on some of the issues that may be discussed here today. But given that general introduction, we welcome Mr. Damian Bilbao from BP, and he will then be followed by ConocoPhillips. But Mr. Bilbao, please, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman.
And we need to have you state your name and affiliation for the record, and so we can make it all proper.
Yes, sir. Co-Chairman Pascovan and Wagner, committee members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Damian Bilbao. I'm the head of finance, developments, and resources for BP Exploration Alaska. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before you today and provide BP's perspective on Senate Bill 192, and more specifically to committee substitute SB 192 version B. I would like to start by recognizing the committee's willingness to discuss and debate Alaska's oil tax policy. It's an important matter, and it's a critical issue for Alaska in both the near term and the long term. So thank you. To stem the decline of oil production on the North Slope, we must continue to have an open dialogue. I talked about this a little bit last week during my testimony. And we have common goals to getting more oil in the pipe, and it's only through this dialogue that we're going to continue that. So once again, we appreciate the opportunity to continue this dialogue. Now, my testimony today will be specific to the CS that's before you. We have not updated our analysis, and we do not plan to do so until there's a new CS. So I will speak to it in its current version. Now, I watched with interest yesterday's testimony from PFC Energy, the legislature's consultant that spoke before you in the afternoon.
If we could just interject for one moment, we've been joined by Senator Stevens. Welcome, Senator. And also in the audience, we have with us Senator Giesel. I don't see any other people that need to be, but we have a full room here in Juneau, but we like to, as a matter of practice, announce the elected officials that are in the audience. So anyway, thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Coachman.
And one more time, we are now being joined by Senator McGuire, so the full committee is here. Welcome, Senator.
So yesterday, I watched the testimony of the legislature's consultant, PFC Energy. They presented their analysis on ACES, SB 192, and the proposed amendments. I found it noteworthy that in their analysis, they suggest that there's only the amendments that provided for bracketing around progressivity provided meaningful tax change that would lead to increased investment in Alaska. Now, when we go back and do our own analysis on the next version of the CS, we'll consider this in our own conversations, and at such time as I come before you again to testify, I'll share some of our thoughts on what the new CS looks like. In BP's opinion, committee substitute to SB 192 version B does not provide meaningful tax change. As you can see from the chart that we've prepared, one of the primary aspects of the CS is a movement in the progressivity feature from 0.4% to 0.35%. A change of 0.05 of a percentage point will not sway our investment decisions in Alaska. It will not affect the decision-making process. It will not materially shift the conversation around the opportunity set. As we have stated previously, only a meaningful tax change, starting with bracketing around progressivity, will draw the additional investment that Alaska needs to put more oil in the pipe. Thank you, Mr. Kutcherman. That's all the prepared statements I had to open. The committee has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Senator Stedman has a question.
I'll lead off. I wanted to get to a question before you got to your presentation because I thought it'd be so quick when you got your slideshow. I missed my opportunity.
Well, Senator Stedman, to the chair, we tried to keep it focused today. It was a save some paper, save the committee members' time. And we also know that ConocoPhillips wanted to make sure to have plenty of time for questions for them, so we kept it brief.
Okay. But on a more serious note, you know, we've had recommendations and we've had discussion, recommendations from our consultants, at least one, and discussion at the committee on basically a kind of a two-tier approach dealing with the legacy fields. One is for current production, and another one discussing a modified tax structure on our legacy fields, and then an additional modified structure for incremental production or new production in the declining legacy fields. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that versus a commingled tax where we try to come up with a tax balance that's dealing with the legacy production and then the incremental.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I think I'll focus my response in two areas. The first one is I think it's fundamentally helpful to the industry when the system is simple. Right now it's not a simple system. It takes a lot of effort to implement, to administrate, and frankly it does not help the decision-making process. Secondly, The fields that we operate, they're expensive fields, producing, non-producing. To try to get into a distinction of one versus the other, I think very fundamentally it's going to come down to what's going to deliver the goals that the state wants. And as if you said, as a committee, the goal ultimately is increased production in the taps. The governor said that. Members of this committee have said that. And what it's going to come down to is it's going to have to be a meaningful change. It's going to have to be a simple and meaningful change so we can implement it. And that's going to come down to, is there going to be bracketing around the progressivity that fundamentally shifts the conversation around the investment decisions? The more simple you can do that, the easier it is for us to analyze it and prioritize our options.
So, I guess I didn't really hear a distinction between the concept that Pedro Van Meers was talking about, having, a tax structure for the legacy fields, and then dealing with the legacy fields incremental production above the current projected production, a lower tax to help alleviate that higher cost, which I think was part of the presentation yesterday by PFC Energy, showing the high cost, a more high cost area, and the challenge with the rates of return and so on and so forth with their presentation. So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're more interested in just a commingled tax structure versus a targeting that incremental production separately, or?
Senator Stemmett, through the chair, we haven't gone back and tried to do a modeling of one versus the other. I can tell you very most fundamentally, it has to come down to overall the fiscal policy has to be has to incentivize investment broadly. And to try to get into a distinction of how much of the investment goes to the base versus the investment that goes above a curve or a line that someone provides at the beginning of the year, ultimately at the end of the day, I don't think it will fundamentally affect the decision-making process. The decision-making process is going to come down to when we look at the project as a whole, when we apply do the economic modeling for the project as a whole and the business on which it sits, we look at the cumulative impact of that. We're going to look to see how is the project affected by the project economics, but we're also going to look to see how that project sits on top of the base business. So we need to make sure that the tax policy makes sure the base business is healthy so you can set a project on top of it. Whether that project is challenged or not, the base business has to be healthy to begin with. So distinguishing between those two may not actually help the conversation. I hope that answers your question.
I have some more, but I'll let you move around the committee.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we've heard it many times. I heard the governor say it again. I heard the public testifiers say it many times, but the general statement that I've heard is that HB 110 is the only bill that the industry has offered commitments to invest. And I would like to know what those commitments are.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, over the last several months, President of BP Alaska, John Minjay, has stated publicly, as has our CFO, Claire Fitzpatrick, that with a meaningful shift in tax policy, that we would support progressing $5 billion of gross incremental spend on the North Slope. Now, that's $5 billion on top of the large level of investment activity that's already ongoing. It takes a significant amount of effort to get to the 6% decline that the state is experiencing today, and that effort requires a lot of folks' efforts. This is on top of that.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, I've got a few questions on this topic because this is something we've heard over and over again. So is this just a BP commitment or is this a BP plus other commitment?
So Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I know this is something that's been a topic of conversation, so I'll try to illuminate it a little bit, and if I fail to do so, I'm sure you'll stop me and ask for more detail. This is a gross investment commitment. It's something that both ConocoPhillips and BP have spoken to publicly. Ultimately, it will require not just an alignment on making sure the right technology and efficiency are there for those projects, with the right fiscal structure. And also, just as a reminder to the committee, BP does continue to be a minority owner in Prudhoe Bay, even though it's the operator. So ultimately, we need to make sure we are aligned with our other working interest owners. The fact that one of them has publicly stated that the project will move forward is a pretty good indicator. And we've also provided some specifics about what those projects would be. So BP has talked about the iPad project. We've talked about SAG redevelopment, which I spoke to a little bit last week during my testimony. And we've also talked about incremental drilling opportunities at both Greater Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk. Now, I believe ConocoPhillips can share with you later what they've stated publicly. I believe their president has talked about the Eastern Northeast West SAG project, which we support. We would support as well in a revised fiscal environment. And that is fundamentally, in total, the $5 billion gross that we've been talking about.
So, Mr. Chair, so you've got iPad. How much is for iPad?
How much of the $5
billion? Yes.
iPad, well, Senator Wilkowski through the chair, I know that the total of the four equal over $5 billion. Now, I think it's important to keep in mind that at this stage of those projects, they are, from a project perspective, there's a wide range. So for me to give you a specific number or any of those, what I do know, because I know we wouldn't speak to this publicly externally, is that the sum of those projects equals over $5 billion. If to provide you with a bit more detail around ranges, I can do that as a follow-up to this testimony, if you'd like.
Well, I'm trying to understand what we would get for our tax give. I'm trying to understand, and I have you run numbers on each one of these projects. It's the iPad, it's SAG redevelopment, it's incremental development drilling at Prudhoe and Kuparuk, did you say?
Yes.
Did I miss anything else?
And the Senator Wilkowski through the chair, I also mentioned E-News project, or East Northeast West SAG, which is a ConocoPhillips operated project at Greater Kuparuk. Those four projects would make up the $5 billion of gross spend. I think it's important to keep in mind not just the input of this equation, the $5 billion gross, but ultimately it's going to be fundamentally the way we measure that through the output of incremental rate that would result from that, the incremental jobs associated in the state, et cetera.
And that would be $5 billion over what period of time?
It would be several, Senator Wilkowski through the chair, it would be several years before you'd be able to spend that level of investment. Most of these projects, in the short term, the incremental drilling could be delivered in the next year or two. The projects themselves would take several years to be fully complete. I would say at least 6 years plus before you're really getting into the bulk of that spend. I can't provide you the exact phasing because ultimately it's going to depend on how the specific projects mature and how they progress within the resources available.
So $5 billion over 6 years, and have you spoken with Exxon about doing this, the other partner?
Senator Wilkowski through the chair, to clarify my statement, I said $5 billion over at least 6 years. So it was before anyone starts dividing $5 billion by six, to be very clear that it would be a period of over 6 years. It could be as much as 10 years, but it's going to depend on what the engineering work says. It's a tremendous amount of spend. These are big, complex projects, and it's not just there's multiple aspects that need to be addressed. There are still some remaining technology challenges that we're working on. There's some fundamental efficiency challenges that we're working on. There is a role to be played by the state in the fiscal environment, but that's just one of three different aspects. And it's the combination of those that will dictate the final schedule of those.
You know, I'm interested in this 10 years. Is there any investment that Alaskans should anticipate after these identified projects? And are you saying there's going to be another $5 billion or $10 billion if these identified projects are completed?
Mr. Chairman, yes. This would effectively be a first phase. Alaska currently, when we discuss globally our opportunity sets, Alaska struggles to compete for the incremental investment opportunities. When we compare to opportunity sets in other parts of the world, the $5 billion is a next phase. The suite of projects that we feel most comfortable have we've made progress on the various technology efficiency fronts, the things that we control. Beyond that, there are other opportunities that would be enabled by the aspects of the challenges that the legislature controls around the tax policy.
And with respect to 0 and 10 years, you know, we've heard the term in your opening, stemming the decline. Do you believe incrementally another 400,000 conventional barrels of oil from state land will be derived from this $5 billion in the next 10 years?
Senator Pascavan, I don't want to set a specific production target for 10 years out for those projects. I think it's going to take more than just these $5 billion to reach that level. But as you asked earlier, there are other projects that, with the right fiscal environment, if we had a fiscal structure with bracketing around progressivity that was a meaningful change to ACES, there would be follow-on opportunities that would materially stem the decline that we're seeing today. We're still seeing a 6% decline. We would expect to see a material offset to that with a meaningful change today to the tax policy.
Ultimately, the question is when you use the term material offset, is that just within the hyperbolic rate of decline?
So, Mr. Chairman, the investment that we make today, the investment we make every day, moves the production line from what could be a 15% decline to the 6% we see today. It takes a tremendous amount of investment to get to the 6. To get beyond that, it takes big material projects, very complex projects. $5 billion is a first phase of what those could be. But that'll only happen if the tax policy that's in place enables them to happen and makes it Alaska competitive with other opportunities around the world.
Co-chair, Senator Wagner had a question, then Senator French.
Let's forget about a lot of the stuff we've heard here already today. Do some simple math. If the legislature were to vote to give back the companies the take we've done on progressivity, and we take the progressivity down to where 110 is, or where Senator McGuire's B4 and B5 is, that's $1.5 billion. Now, you're talking about a $5 billion spend in 6 years. Within 6 years, you're going to get $9 billion credited back to you by the give on progressivity. In 10 years, you're going to get $15 billion credited back. So whose $5 billion are we talking about investing to bring these projects online? I'm just trying to sort the math out in my mind, because it looks to me like if you're figuring on using what we give up in progressivity to invest on the $5 billion, we haven't gained a lot. Senator, so I'm looking for the gain.
Sure. Senator Wagner, through the chair, the $5 billion of projects, as I said, is a first phase of opportunity, and there are opportunities after that. As you yourself pointed out during last week's hearing, when we first developed Prudhoe Bay, it required a significant infusion of spend without any revenue, and that's what it requires to create a new business, a significant upfront investment. Where Alaska is today, this is effectively a transition point to another new business. We've renewed our infrastructure over the last several years to facilitate 30 more years of production. It's going to require significant upfront investment to do that. And there may be times, whether it's these five projects or other material projects that are in addition to these, whether they're heavy oil or other at-scale projects, where Alaska may need, or BP in Alaska may need, to begin to draw funds from elsewhere in the world into Alaska to fund those large-scale opportunities. To sit here today and try to tell you exactly how much is coming in and out, I can't give you those numbers. What I can tell you is it's a significant ramp-up of activity, and we're taking it a piece at a time, and I can speak to the $5 billion that are before us today.
Senator French had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I think Senator Wagner's pointed out some of the math problems that beset us, although to be fair, I think that we probably would have to push $9 billion across the table to get $6 billion in tax breaks to the company because of the federal income tax effect. That is, the Fed's going to grab billions of those dollars, and they never get to the industry to help stimulate more investment. My question actually goes back to something that Senator Wilkowski asked that didn't get addressed, and that was the role of Exxon in this investment scheme.
Senator French, the chair, is the question, have we discussed these projects with Exxon, or is the question, what is Exxon's position?
Both. Yeah, have you discussed with Exxon? What's their position? Are they contributing to the $5 billion? Because when you said $5 billion, you mentioned you and Conoco, and you did not mention Exxon.
Senator French, to the chair. Yes, we have discussed these projects and others. We regularly discuss a hopper of opportunities with our working interest owners. Those conversations involve not just the economics, but also fundamentally the technical challenges, the efficiency challenges. And it's that debate that often ensures that we are staying focused to stay aligned. In terms of Exxon's position, frankly, Senator, you're going to have to ask them directly.
Fair enough. But let me just make sure, as far as you're concerned, the $5 billion pledge is just representing what you and Conoco are putting forward. It does not include any money from Exxon.
Senator French, to the chair, I can't speak for ConocoPhillips. I'm sure you'll ask them that question in a few minutes. What I can tell you is in conversations that we have had and in comments that we have both made externally, they have been around the same common set of projects.
And that's a combined spend between your two companies?
Senator French, to the chair, yes.
And with respect to Prudhoe Bay, what percentage of ownership does Exxon have there? I forget. I know it's a stake, but I can't remember. Just know roughly. It doesn't have to be exact, just roughly.
Senator French, to the chair, let me correct my previous statement just to be very, very clear. The $5 billion is the total gross spend, not just BP and Conoco's share. It would include Exxon's share of that $5 billion. It's the $5 billion of project spend. So I just want to make sure that's clear.
So you are including the Exxon in the $5
billion? Senator French, to the chair, yes. The $5 billion is the total estimate for those four investment opportunities. We're not differentiating around who would pay for what amount. We're talking about what level of investment ultimately would benefit the state of Alaska with meaningful tax change.
But you're also telling me to go check with Exxon as to their position on this.
Senator French, to the chair, what I'm saying is you can only ask Exxon specifically whether they are prepared to move forward those projects at what velocity. I can't speak on behalf of ExxonMobil.
And I'm not asking to. But let's go back to the Prudhoe Bay ownership issue. How much of Prudhoe does Exxon own?
Senator French, to the chair, approximately 35%, roughly the same amount as ConocoPhillips. BP owns approximately 26%.
Okay. Nobody is a majority. No single company is a majority owner.
Senator French, to the chair, without getting into the decimals, I couldn't answer that question. But fundamentally, the way the contract, the operating agreement for Prudhoe Bay works is it requires the three parties to agree to move something forward.
That's the point I was getting at. I've had one of the most illuminating conversations I ever had, maybe in my time in the legislature, was during a lunch with Jeff Lowenfels, who is, if nothing else, a highly entertaining individual, and he's absolutely focused on the Prudhoe Bay operating agreement as being sort of the single document that people have to understand in order to get sort of what's going on in the North Slope. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's just his perspective. It inspired me to get a copy of the Prudhoe Bay operating agreement that I have in my office. It's 8 binders long. You know it. It's a very complex document. But my understanding of the Prudhoe Bay operating agreement, as much as I've dipped into it and read it, is that your position is correct. It requires the agreement of all three owners to proceed with an investment in Prudhoe Bay. And that leaves me with a deep fear that you can pledge $5 billion and in all good faith believe it and have the check ready to write. And Exxon can say, no, we don't like it, and we're not going to do it. And then we're all back to zero. That's my fear. Thank you.
Senator Stedman, rotating around the table.
Right. And I apologize for coughing now and then. I'm just trying to get over this cold, Mr. Chairman. Let me follow up a little bit on Senator French's. He'll come back again to me for some other questions. But I have a similar concern dealing with the operating agreement, and as we work through this tax structure, and earlier I'd asked you about this two-tiered approach that was recommended by our consultants, one for the legacy fields, current production, plus the 6% that you have, and then some other mechanism to give a reduced rate to future production to help the rate of return analysis at, and hurdle rates and all that. But all three companies have different objectives or whatever, and I'm struggling with how do we get a how do we get a solution where all three companies are comfortable, because it seems like we'd always be chasing the lowest common denominator and whatever decision point we're trying to work through, and there's multiple ones within the process here. So could you help me with that? How, you know, I mean, if we took care of BP's targets, whatever the significant change is, but, you know, I still don't know what that is, but whatever it is, it may not be, you know, meaningful and significant to Conoco or Exxon. So how can you help the committee as we try to mentally work through this exercise to, so we can try to get to a solution that works?
Senator Simmons, through the chair, of course I can only speak on behalf of BP, but I'll try to do my best to answer your question. We have commented publicly, and I believe the other companies have as well, that the bracketing of progressivity that was included in HB 110 represented a material shift, but it was, I believe the quote was, chinning the bar on a meaningful tax change. We encouraged changes even beyond what was in HB 110, but that sets a minimum threshold, if you will, of what would represent a meaningful change. Another aspect of this, which I think is important, and back to your original question, is to understand the way that we evaluate our projects and the opportunity set. We do not look at the projects in isolation. So we certainly understand what the economics of those projects are. We don't just look at the spend up front and the revenue back, but we look at the impact of the entire policy, not aspects of the policy. But we also look at the way that that project then sits on top of the base business, the existing business, if you will. So if I know how much my production and financials look like for the next 10, 20 years, I then need to understand how sitting that project on top of it will impact my financials for the next 10 to 20 years. So it's important that the existing business, the underlying financials, are healthy, not just the project that I sit on top of it. So the fiscal policy needs to affect both. And to try to differentiate one versus the other misses the mark a little bit on how that analysis takes place. So fundamentally what it's going to come down to is that the policy as a whole needs to encourage, needs to provide a stable and healthy business on top of which healthy projects can be executed.
Just a follow-up. I understand what you're saying, and I think we've talked about some of the stuff with our consultants and other meetings, and, you know, you have a iPad or whatever project it is, and you isolate that, and then you bring it into your entire organization and see what happens to your overall cash flow and effective tax rates, and are you better off with it or without it. And there's been quite a bit of discussion about the high marginal rates affecting that, where it would push an incremental project or an additional project under review when you bring it back in, particularly if you don't allocate any expenses to it, it drives the overall tax rate up. One of the things that we struggle with here is we know you have expenses. It's going to cost you something if it's $5 billion for five projects or what have you, and we don't really see that detail, you know, to know where we're actually at. And as an example, even something that's with a broader brush, if we look at the overall base in the, you know, this our revenue source book, which we quote a lot, I mean, it's kind of a condensed high level view, but it gives us a rough idea of revenue and expenses. And when we calculate the taxes on that, you know, it looks like You know, we've got somewhere in 13 and of around, a 33-34% effective rate at $109 for everybody. But then when you take take out the small producers that have no revenue and have 400 or so million in credits embedded in the system, and take out a little bit of CapEx, 800 million or some number, at least from the earlier presentations, it looks like the effective rate of the industry, the three majors, is somewhere around, you know, 38, 39, I don't know, somewhere up in there. But we don't really know. But that's about as far down as we can drill, and it's pretty rudimentary. So it makes it difficult for us when we look at the aggregate overall and we set our tax rates through progressivity or whatever we're working with, and we look at our government share numbers, and we think, you know, with all well intention, that that's the rates that you're under when you may be under a rate that's 5% higher internally. And I don't, you know, and I'm just using that as a ballpark number because I don't know what your rate is. And I don't know what part of the big three, you know, how you make up that part of the big three. We use roughly a third, and a third, just because it's easy for us. So it's not, our models aren't near as clear or as accurate as yours, because we just don't have the data. So that's why we, you know, we're asking for, I guess, some guidance or help in how to solve that incremental production question that we're all concerned with, to get you above the 6%, because our consultant's going to spend some time, PFC Energy, talking to us just about how much that cost. From the normal decline of 14, 15, you get it up to 6, what's that cost? And then what's it going to cost extra to get north of there? And I don't know what that is, but it's not going to be cheap, like you're referencing here. Mm-hmm. So it makes it difficult, I guess, from my side of the table, when I know I've got three major players all have to agree. I have no idea what the targets of either one of them are, other than, you know, something significant, and I don't know what that is. I really don't. I mean, you're telling me that the bracketing's significant, but what I hear when you tell me that is high marginal rates, fix the marginal rate issue, fix the government share issue, and don't erode my, or give me a fair share of real high oil prices. Don't take it all. But I don't know if that's what you're saying, or I'm just hearing what I want to hear. So you can respond to that any way you want to. I just, but any of the guidance and help you can give us is beneficial as we go through this process.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I'll try to take those in a few different pieces. So the first one is regarding, I guess, an interest in additional information. I can tell you that each month, every quarter, we provide a tremendous amount of information to the Department of Revenue, to the point where down to a lease level, we provide a great deal of granularity, joint interest billings, AFEs with CONE, with the working interest owners. And we also spend a lot of time trying to answer their questions and help them analyze the information. The Alaska government, at the end of the day, has a large amount of information to analyze it for our operations. And if there's anything we can do to answer questions about that to the Department of Revenue, we're happy to do so. With regards to your question about what is meaningful mean, I think each of the separate producers have come forward and talked about what their role opinion was of HB 110 and the elements of HB 110. I think from BP's perspective, we've shared that it was a start. It was chinning the bar on meaningful. We would have liked to see a reduction in the base rate. But the bracketing and progressivity does make a significant impact on our evaluation of projects. And fundamentally, what it comes down to is at $120 or whatever dollars a barrel, when we look at our projects, We may not sit down and look at what the specific effective tax rate or the marginal tax rate, but we do look to see what is the upside opportunity at a higher price versus whatever planning price we're using. And if we're not seeing that upside at a higher price, then that affects the way that project competes globally.
If I could follow up, just on that point. So then one of your concerns is the splitting of that extra, just say hypothetically, 120 to 130, make a $10 incremental, make it easy, that increment, and how that's shared between the industry. It certainly, for those watching at home, it's not 50-50. It's probably 80-20 or some number, without looking it up, some number in there. But you would like to have that stabilized, is what I'm hearing. Well, maybe not that ratio, but have that split corrected in your view, and then have it stabilized so you could, when you look forward, if you had a price spike of 150, you would have a good idea what impact it would have on your projects.
Senator Simmons, through the chair, the legislature's own consultants have said that the current tax system is not competitive internationally. It does not incentivize the investment. In fact, PFC Energy yesterday, if I remember correctly, said in their analysis to date, ACES is a system that encourages a harvest mode, not a growth mode. And I think that's representative of the analysis we see when we look at the projects. So if we go back and look at a project that at $100 versus $120, we do not see an upside from moving that forward. That's going to affect the way that project competes globally with opportunities elsewhere.
Yes. Just briefing this, and I'll be quiet and somebody else has questions. But one of our consultants, Pedro Van Meers, also said that he thought that the tax structure within our legacy fields and current production should be capped at a government share rate at somewhere around 75%. And that, for those at home, that would include federal.
Senator Simmons, through the chair, Dr. Van Meers did speak about different rates for different projects. Fundamentally, he also spoke of the fact the Alaska system is not competitive internationally. Frankly, looking at some of the numbers he was using, his cost assumptions were very low. Our costs were much higher than what he had in there, so it would not surprise me to see some of the recommendations he put out there that was still would not move the needle in the way we look at our projects.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Great questions. Trying to put a little better understanding to the public, under the committee substitute for 192, at current price ranges that we're at now, $120 to $130 a barrel, the reduction in production tax ranges between about $375 million a year and $500 million a year. You know, and that's what the numbers that were presented with us yesterday, and what's so some Alaskans may think that is most meaningful. You know, when you're talking $375 million a year or $500 million a year, but then when they think about that over your 10-year, investment of your $5 billion. You take that $375 million, that becomes $3.75 billion, or you take the $500 million, and it becomes $5 billion over that 10 years. And again, that starts raising the question, who's doing the investment? And, so it's just, I think that's in part some of the issue that is on the table right now. So,
that's
Senator.
Cool. Yes, that's kind of what I was getting at.
Senator Willikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm still trying to make sure I understand that the promise that the people of Alaska are getting in exchange for the tax break, and are you saying, as you sit here, with absolutely 100% certainty that if we pass HB 110, that we will get the $5 billion investment over 6 to 10 years?
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, no, I can't make that statement. What I can tell you is that if you pass meaningful change like that which was represented in HB 110 with bracketing around progressivity, which is a meaningful change in taxes, that we would move forward aggressively in conversations with our other working interest owners, that we would ramp up staffing around these projects to make sure that they can move forward aggressively. But I cannot speak on behalf of some of the other working interest owners other than the comments they've already made publicly in support of some of these projects under a different tax environment.
So essentially, we really don't have any promise or commitment to develop or invest $5 billion if we pass HB 110. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, you have an absolute commitment that 3 years from now, if you pass a meaningful tax change in Alaska, that you can bring us before this committee and hold us to account if you haven't seen the progress you expect.
One follow-up, yeah. And then I want to make sure Conoco gets the opportunity. Well, many of these questions can be addressed by
I think that's a wonderful idea.
We don't want to have Mr. Bilbao have all the fun. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to share the time with Conoco.
Well, I appreciate the conversation, but that $5 billion, it's my understanding that the $5 billion you're saying that you may spend over 6 to 10 years, the state actually picks up 60% of that through tax credits and deductions. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, without getting into the financial treatment of the $5 billion, that's $5 billion we're not spending somewhere else in the world. Our share of that $5 billion is money we're not spending else in the world. When we look at these investment decisions, we're looking at the capital we're taking that year, and that's not being spent somewhere else that could deliver return to the firm.
Okay, but I'm trying to understand is that a $5 billion of your money, or because my understanding is if it's a $5 billion gross investment, you're getting 60% back. The state's actually paying for 60% of it, or $3 billion. Or are you saying $5 billion of your own money, exclusive of state tax credits and deductions?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, when we talk cash, we talk in cash flow terms, not in net income terms or tax-impacted terms. So $5 billion is $5 billion of cash gross, and BP's share of that being spent in support of those projects.
And how many? Okay.
One follow-up question, and then I do want to.
Just a brief comment. We can have those run, but you're correct that the $5 billion would – 20% of it would probably be available for capital credits and 100% write-off. But we can have those calculations run because it digs a deeper hole than when getting to Senator Wagner's question, the net.
Just one last question, Mr. Chair. How many barrels of oil do we get from the $5 billion investment that may be made?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I can only speak to the off the top of my head to the SAG and iPad pieces of that, it's over 200 million barrels. But let me get back to you with more specifics rather than try to take a guess to what the total $5 billion would be.
Thank you.
And Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, just to be entirely clear, it'll be a range. It's too early to put a specific number on those.
You described the field size, not the daily throughput.
Mr. Sherman, that's correct.
I just want to make sure so that the listening public.
Not 200 million barrels per day, it was 200 million barrels in total.
Yeah, quick question. Total recoverable?
Senator Wagner, yes.
Yeah.
Total recoverable.
Thank you.
Mr. Bilbao, thank you very much. We now spread a little fun around and Mr. Bob Heinrich and Scott Jepson from Conoco, we do appreciate, your having prepared slides, and we do want you to have the opportunity to present to us. So we thank you, Mr. Bilbao.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Committee members.
Brief at ease while we transition. back on record, Senate Resource Committee comes back to order at approximately 4:30. We are pleased to have joining us today from ConocoPhillips, Bob Heinrich, Vice President of Finance, and Scott Jepson, Vice President of External Affairs. On behalf of Senate Resources Committee, welcome to the both of you. Please identify yourself, and the floor will be yours for your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Scott Jepson, and I am Vice President of External Affairs for ConocoPhillips Alaska.
I'm Bob Heinrich, Vice President of Finance for ConocoPhillips Alaska.
Before we get into the heart of our presentation, I wanted to make a few overview comments. First, I want to thank the committee for inviting us in to provide comments on the committee's substitute for SB 192. As you know, we strongly believe that the key to making the North Slope more attractive for capital investment is reducing or eliminating the progressivity element of ACES. We are pleased that the committee has attempted to address progressivity, but we have concluded that the changes as described in the committee's substitute for SB 192 are not significant and will not improve the investment climate on the North Slope. We have also looked at the other amendments that have been proposed that address progressivity and have concluded that only the amendments that are based upon a bracketing concept have the potential to have a material impact. There are a number of other amendments that have been proposed, but because they do not address progressivity, the biggest lever that we see to improve the North Slope business environment, we don't have specific comments on the other amendments today. However, should the committee adopt some of the proposed provisions into SB 192, we would welcome the opportunity to come back and discuss any changes to the bill. Today, we're not in a position to say that there is a single provision out there that would make the North Slope more attractive for capital investment, partly because we need to see what the final bill would look like. But we do have some slides that we've prepared that will help you understand how we've drawn the conclusions that we've drawn, and we'll run through those and then answer any questions that you might have.
Sure, and I would hope that you would, from the sense of the questioning of Mr. Bilbao, understand generally the focus of the committee at this time, and if you could address some of those concepts, it would be most appreciated.
The first slide that we have is a barrel slide, and we put this together to demonstrate the fact that the committee substitute for SB 192 really doesn't provide any material change to ACES. Let me just walk through the basis for the slide first. What we used to construct this slide was the fall 2011 revenue source book for fiscal year 2013. And you can see some of the key assumptions in there in terms of federal tax rate, state income tax rate, et cetera. So just walking through the slices on the barrel, the very bottom of it, $34, represents the capital costs and operating costs, et cetera, that were summarized in the revenue source book. Moving up to that, the next slice is industry share, then you have federal income tax, and then you have Alaska's share. And Alaska's share includes royalty, severance tax, income tax, and property tax. And as you can see, looking at this, if you just let your eye kind of run across the top of the industry share slices, there is some uplift for industry as prices increase, but it pales in comparison to what you see with as a state share grows with price increase. Basically, the state share grows at a rate about five times industry share as price goes up. When we take a look at investments in Alaska, we take a look at the total risk-reward equation. We take a look at the risk that we take in terms of the reservoirs that we're drilling into, the capital risk, the technology risk. And we also take a look at a number of economic metrics before we make that investment decision. And part of that is, what is our long-term cash flow potential going to look like as margins increase? And right now in the state of Alaska, because of the progressivity element and the impact that it has on the marginal tax rate, we don't see the upside in Alaska that makes it a terribly interesting place to invest for incremental capital. It's not to say that we're not investing. We do invest. We invest at the rate of around $900 million a year. But the key to making Alaska more attractive for additional investment is going to be to change the progressivity element of ACES. Now, Bob Heinrich has some line graphs that he's going to run through that will demonstrate on a sort of different perspective how Senate Bill 192 compares, as well as a number of the amendments.
This chart you've seen before, the solid lines on it were part of the testimony we had a couple of weeks ago. And what we're doing is demonstrating the split in cash flow between Alaska and the industry across a range of prices. It's from the most recent revenue source book information modeled for the fiscal year 2013. To clear the slide a little further, the x-axis is the Alaska North Slope crude price rather than using the PTV or production tax value. From that crude price, you deduct $40 to get back to a PTV value. The solid red line, as I said, and the green solid green line represent the Alaska share and the industry share under the ACES structure as it's modeled or as it exists today. The diamond marked lines represent the Alaska and industry shares under the Committee Substitute Bill 192. A couple other notes on the slide is the Alaska share includes royalties, production taxes, state income taxes, and property taxes, while the industry share is the net after federal income tax also. So it's what's retained by the industry, the Alaska being what's paid into the state in different forms. Main observation.
Mr. If I could just interject, you know, what we were shown yesterday was at, for example, $120 a barrel, that the reduction in production tax would be about $375 million, and at $130 a barrel, the reduction would be about $500 million a year. And is that gap set forth in this chart?
It's... Senator Pascavan, if you take a look at the chart that we showed you a second ago that showed industry share and state share as a function of oil price, you take a look at the barrel chart, you'll see there's about a $2 a barrel decrease in state share and going from ACES to Bill 192 at about $125 a barrel. So you can, if you do the math, you can take the number of barrels that you think are produced in that particular year, you'll probably come out, I think, somewhere in that range.
In other words, I want to make sure that we're even on slide three, that those figures, so that we're all on the same so to speak.
Mr. Chairman, they won't likely match exactly because our models, I believe, are done on a different basis. This is using the 2013 price data for a static year, and I believe the PFC data is done on a longer-term economic basis. So there's going to be some differences.
Just for purposes, they on page 23 of the PFC performance, they did it based on the FY 2013 DOR estimate inputs. So that's why I specifically want to make sure that if you're saying that gap, I am believing that gap represents $375 million a year at $120 a barrel and about $500 million a year at $130. And Senator Stedman.
Just for a question, I think PFC had a slight oversight in their calculation of property tax, so they've got about a $300 million error in there that they're going to rectify. And then I think they also used the data off the back of the book, which is a summary table, as you know, and the data is a little different than forward into the tables. Okay. So they may not exactly line up, but I think the visual representation should lead to the same similar conclusions.
Yeah, I believe on, Chairman, I believe our at the 120 price range, our calculation was more than the $250 million impact. Is that correct, Scott?
Well, we're all in the ballpark here. Yeah. It's really difficult to read that chart and figure out is that $250 million or $350 million. But just doing a rough calculation sitting here, the $2 a barrel difference in state share between CSB 192 and ACES is about $350 million at $125 a barrel in that particular year at that particular price point.
Thank you. I think it just trying to
Yeah, we're in the ballpark.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's
appreciate your patience with us. We've been working a lot over the last few days to come up with the material. So
just trying to get to common ground so at least we can establish.
But the main observations, at least on a graphical basis, is does not make a material change in the hyper-progressivity results from ACES. The industry share still remains flat, relatively flat over the range of prices, while the Alaska share increases more dramatically over the price range. And the committee substitute bill 192 doesn't make a material difference in creating that robust investment climate. This next chart is, we've added a few dashed lines to it, which represents the split of cash under ACES, excluding the progressivity feature. We talked about that as one objective in a prior testimony, either improvement or possibly elimination of progressivity altogether. As we've said before, it's the aspect of ACES that makes Alaska a less desirable area for investment for ConocoPhillips. Again, a couple of observations. What you see across the range of prices is that Alaska does receive a higher portion of the cash flow from the industry, and even without progressivity, it participates in the benefit of higher prices.
Senator Stedman.
I don't blame you for asking for elimination of progressivity, but it would put us in a position, I think, of being in a slightly regressive from a progressive. And we could argue that we're maybe a little too progressive, but to turn around and make us regressive, we'd probably be in the same shoes you are today. And wouldn't be very happy. but I just did a quick rough calculation before I came here and took out progressivity just for an exercise. Again, this is just the aggregate of everybody, and the three producers' rates are a little bit higher because they actually have production and pay taxes versus some guys that just consume credits and, move the averages down. But the average aggregate overall effect of the Treasury, we would have a effective rate of about 17.5%. And I think under ELF, back in the 80s, I would expect that rate to be our effective rate somewhere on the gross, to be somewhere in the high teens and low 20s, and I think we were squealing back then, at least in retrospect now. So I understand the desire to head this direction, but I don't think it's likely that we're going to end up there. Maybe we'll be somewhere in the middle when we're done.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, we understand, but we did want to put it on there just as a reference point to really make the point that even without progressivity, the state share does increase with oil price, and it's actually greater than industry share. We understand that's probably not a politically realistic objective at this point.
And then in just balancing out the tax structure, I don't think it's desirable, because we have this impact on credits coming at us, which take out progressivity, the effective tax rate 25%, but then your credits come against that and drags that down, and I didn't do the calculation to see what the effective tax rate would be once we took out the small explorers and just looked at the three big dogs and what happens, but I ran out of time. I don't think I need to do that exercise. It would be a very attractive fiscal system for you.
Yes, Senator Stedman, through the chair, that is part of the challenge in analyzing one aspect or one moving part of the lever. As we talked about, there are many levers at work, and the credits are another side of balancing that equation. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Heinrich, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This next slide adds on the amendments B8 and B18, which reduce the cap from 50% to 35% of the existing progressivity element, and it adjusts B18 actually adjusts inserts and adjusts the trigger points under progressivity. They're represented in this graphic by the X marked lines, which are very hard to see, and because they overlay basically the existing lines for ACES and Committee Substitute Bill 192. Which really, again, indicates there's no noticeable effect from those specific amendments. There are caps that come into play, but they're well outside the price range that we're analyzing here, somewhere past the $200 per barrel mark. In our view of the world, this price range, 100 to 150, is the range we'll be working in for some time. And then this last...
Just before you go, could you just briefly hit on again what B18... Not sure everybody follows along, because B8, what those actually mean.
Yeah, B8 is an amendment that reduces the current ACES structure has a cap of progressivity add-on of 50%, which would make the tax of the base rate 25% plus 50 at 75%. So it would cap it instead of 50 at 35% for a total rate of 60. Okay? I don't have the details on B8 in front of me, but I believe it reduces the first trigger point, the second trigger point of progressivity, where the rate goes from 0.4 to 0.1, and reduces it from 92.92.5 PTV down to 67.5. So it brings further back in time the point where the slope of the increase changes.
Okay.
Thank you. What we've done with this last slide, and I'm not going to add any more lines after this. So, but it's to illustrate amendments B4 and B5, and those are two that relate to the bracketed structure. Just to refresh on brackets, that's the system or approach that provides for a higher tax rates on an incremental income basis as prices rise. So as prices rise, a higher tax rate applies to only the incremental income generated as a result of that higher price and not the entire income stream. For most folks, it's more familiar as how the federal income tax system works for a personal basis, such that as your income rises, only the income in the next tax bracket is taxed at the higher rate. Okay? The triangle lines here, both in green and red, that are roughly halfway between the ACES and other amendments line and the no progressivity line, represent the split of cash between Alaska and industry across those price ranges under a bracketed structure. The results, we view these results are more equitable split as prices rise, and it will create a material enough change in the investment climate to result in a measurable change in investment activity.
You know, you were referencing the $150 a barrel range, and again, subject to modification by PFC, the indication is that that range, the reduction in production tax is approximately $3 billion a year. Is that approximately accurate?
Senator Pascavan, through the chair. Senator Pascavan, I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman. If you just take a look at the graph that we've prepared at $150 a barrel, you can pretty much read off the chart the difference in state share as a function of oil price. So I think you're probably in that same range, in that range that you're talking about.
I just want to make sure that so when people look at the chart, they understand what it means in translating it to money, because I think that's what everyone is trying to comprehend, you know, and so $3 billion per year at $150 a barrel.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good observation because, you know, we are dealing in very large numbers. We're dealing in billions of dollars to the state, billions of dollars that we spend, billions of dollars to the federal government. That's part of the thing I think that makes this a difficult discussion is because these are very large numbers, and we talk about small changes. The small changes end up being large numbers. But at the end of the day, if we make this a better place for investment, for capital investment, I think the $5 billion we've talked about is the leading edge. It's not just investment by the big three. I would anticipate that if this is a better place for capital investment, you'll see more outside companies out there doing business. You've seen it happen in Canada. You've seen it happen in other places around the world. We've talked about that. Others have talked about it, so I don't want to rehash that here. But what we're talking about here is a snapshot in time. It doesn't take into account the fact that you might have increased production if you lower the severance tax rate, that you're going to have new reserves that people are going to develop. You're going to have more investment. You're going to have more property taxes, more people employed. So this is just a potential outcome, and it's one that really doesn't capture what we think would happen in the state if we saw a severance tax change. But it is a sensitivity at just this particular instance in time. But I fully believe that if we have a meaningful change to the severance tax, investment will ramp up, and we will have a longer, more robust economic future for this state.
And I understand that statement completely. Again, I think what people are trying to comprehend is if it's $2 billion a year or $3 billion a year and it's magnified over 10 years, how does that compare to the $5 billion investment over that 10-year period? I think that's the push and shove, so to speak, that people are trying to understand more completely, and then taking it then the next step further, even assuming the $5 billion is actually invested over the next 10 years, is there any throughput above 600,000 barrels, or is this just a continuation of that hyperbolic decline curve that we've heard about?
Mr. Chairman, that's a difficult question to answer, because right now we don't know the entire suite of projects that would materialize if we have a significant change to ACES. I think when, you know, when all this discussion first started about these projects, the question was asked, what will you do? What will you commit to if there's a change to ACES? So the projects that were identified are those that are really sitting in our queue right now. These are projects that we've been working on for a while that are challenged by ACES, that are challenged in our, when we go back and try to get the corporate money to invest in these projects because of the impact ACES has on the risk-reward balance. But we have a lot of engineers, a lot of geologists, a lot of geophysicists, and it's their job to come up with new projects. And, you know, I've been in this business for over 30 years, and I've been up here a long time, and I can tell you we're doing projects now that we never envisioned 20 years ago or even 15 years ago. So I think it's there will be significant changes. There's probably far more money to be spent up here. You know, we talk about the $5 billion. Industry as a whole is spending over $2 billion a year just as is. So we're talking incremental spend above that, and I think there's incremental spend beyond that. But at this point in time, you know, a lot of these decisions are board-level decisions. We can tell you what we've said we will do. When that conversation, when that question was first asked, we put some projects on the table that, like I said, have been identified. I fully believe there are other projects out there that we will identify as time goes on. So I'll be quiet for a moment.
Thank you very much, Senator Willikowski.
Yeah, thank you. So are you saying that none of those $5 billion projects will go forward over the next 10 years unless we pass a bill similar to HB 110?
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, I can reiterate something that I said the last time I was down here. We talked about news. We identified Eastern, Northeast, WESAC as one of those projects that's challenged by ACES. The real challenge in that project lies in the pace that we do it and how much actually gets done. So I can't sit here and tell you none of these will get done, because some portion of some of these projects may actually get done. But it's going to be a function of how long does it take and how much do we actually accomplish. In Northeast WESAC, which is a viscous oil accumulation, there are lots of locations out there, a significant chunk of the resource, which is very, very challenged from a technical point of view and recovery point of view. And whether or not we can attract the investment to go out and drill up those locations is really going to be a function of, you know, are we going to get the balance in terms of the risk-reward equation?
If I could just follow up on that, to some extent, when you talk about the viscous or heavy oil, it goes back to Senator Stedman's question about the difference between the legacy fields and this new production, so to speak. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
I'll say something. I'll let Bob chime in here in a minute. A couple of thoughts on that. You know, the oil that we're producing today is based on the tens of billions of investment that we've made over the past years. And, you know, quite frankly, the tax environment wasn't the same then as it is today. It was quite a bit lower. I think you could make an equitable argument that moving the entire base back down to something more reasonable is a fair thing to do. And then just in terms of, you know, trying to isolate new versus old, that is fraught with all kinds of technical problems. I can see us having many months of discussion about where we're going to draw that line, what's new, what's old, how do you allocate expenses between new and old. A lot of the opportunities that we see are in the existing oil fields. As we talked about before, we're basically developing new oil fields as we speak inside Kuparuk, in the Kuparuk Reservoir. We're using 3D seismic to go out and identify specific fault blocks, which we cannot reach using conventional drilling. We're drilling horizontal wells to hit those fault blocks. But this, in essence, is new oil for all practical purposes in many instances. So trying to then say, okay, we're going to separate that from the legacy field. We're going to try and separate the costs. We're going to try and separate the overall cost structure. And then we're going to try to measure it. That becomes a system, I think, that's fraught with a lot of difficulties.
Maybe changing the definition a little bit or slightly from new to just incremental oil. You know, could you expand on that? In other words, I don't want to too narrowly define, you know, the our discussion, you know, if you could more broadly define it as incremental oil.
We did look at, there were a couple amendments that were attempting to target incremental oil and provide reduction, and we modeled or tried to model those. I'm not sure if we got it quite right in the short time frame we had, but the way we looked at those, incremental relief, tax relief or reduction for a short period of time, i.e. the 1 year following increased production, was not enough to significantly move the needle in terms of the actual change in tax rate. Please continue.
We're getting close to the end of our prepared presentation. We started the presentation with a barrel slide that compared SB 192 to ACES, and we thought we would conclude the presentation with something that compared B5, a bracketing amendment, to ACES. And, you know, we want to be completely open in terms of what this means. The state share between B5 and ACES would decrease. But if you just take a look at what's happening with the state share between $100 a barrel and $150 a barrel, state share is going up about 2 times. Industry share is going about 1.5 times, 1.4 times. In our opinion, a change of this sort would be sufficient to attract additional capital investment into the state. But again, we'd have to look at it in terms of the entirety of whatever comes out of this body in the House in terms of what the overall balance looks like in terms of decreases in progressivity or any other changes that that one might make. So lastly, just a few summary comments. We've talked about how a bracketed progressivity has the potential to have a positive material impact on the severance tax, but it doesn't have to be just bracketing. There are other ways you can get to that same point. You can do it by making a bigger change in progressivity, for instance. You can make it by decreasing the cap even further and having a highly progressive system. So we're not fixated on one particular solution. We understand that at the end of the day, it's probably going to be a mix of several different sorts of things, but what we see with amendments B4 and B5, that is a significant change, and as Bob said, that would change our perspective on capital investment in Alaska on the North Slope. One thing that we didn't talk about was the inflation indexing progressivity of trigger points. That certainly has the potential to provide more durability to a tax regime in the sense that you don't end up having inflation kind of creep up on you and changing what was intended by the brackets or the progressivity trigger points that are part of whatever sort of severance tax change that might come out. Then lastly, I just want to reiterate that SB 192, the committee substitute as currently proposed, won't change the investment climate, but we are very encouraged that this committee, that the Senate, is looking at progressivity, and we hope to continue having the dialogue and we can get to something where at the end of the day we can say this is the change that will make Alaska the place where we think we can increase our capital investment. That concludes our comments.
You know, one of the portions of the presentation yesterday that was interesting to me was the difference between the analysis under a low-cost development and a high-cost development. You know, I know we've used the homogenized Department of Revenue FY13 numbers, and so it's hard to understand any particular application when we just have a homogenized look. Is there any way that we could see, you know, within your structures of a low-cost development and a high-cost development so that we can have a more complete understanding of actual operation as compared to just this blended, homogenized presentation? That's what we're dealing with.
Mr. Chairman, and one of the things that we talk about when this discussion comes up is as soon as that project is executed, it's part of the base now. It's not independent. We don't differentiate. You know, the operator doesn't only go to this well or just to this development over there. It becomes part of our integrated operation. So I think looking at it in a homogenized fashion, particularly when you're trying to take a look at Alaska in terms of what is the long-term cash flow potential look like in Alaska? We're not going to just separate out a project. We're going to take a look at the entire portfolio. It's basically a portfolio analysis in terms of the tax regime that we're in. It's not really an individual project analysis.
Yeah, and again, what I'm trying to focus on is this incremental production, you know, which I assume this incremental production will be your high-cost development, and trying to get an understanding of where those, you know, we've heard the term move the needle. Well, if we... better numbers would give us an idea of what it would take on incremental production to do that, move the needle. And so that's, you know, it It's just an observation, Senator Stedman has a question.
Several times through the meetings has been brought up, you know, several years ago under Kaparik, we had a virtually a zero severance tax. And why under that scenario, which was back when we were in our decline curve, why wasn't there a big build out and, you know, the needle in all retrospect should have been pegged and the whole place lit economically on fire? And it would be in the effect of taking out our base tax and our progressivity and stripping this thing down to just basically, well, more royalties, but pretty much stripping it out. So can you help us with that concept? Because it's certainly been kicked out on the table several times.
Senator Stedman, through the chair. I did go back and do a little research in terms of what was going on in that time frame from about 1998 to the mid-2000s. In that time frame, we brought on the first viscous oil projects at 1C and 1D. We brought on the Dabasco oil field. We brought on the Tarn field. We brought on Meltwater. We brought on West Sac 1B, 1E, and 1J, basically the core West Sac area. In the Prudhoe area, the Midnight Sun, Polaris, Aurora, Borealis, Orion fields were brought on stream. Alpine was brought on stream in that time frame, as were the Fjord and the Nook satellites. So I guess my perspective is that we were on fire. We were bringing on a lot of new fields in that same time frame. What you're fighting, though, is you're fighting one of the biggest oil fields in North America is declining, as well as Prudhoe Bay's decline. And while these fields are all very significant, it's pretty tough to offset, you know, a 20% decline on a field that's producing, you know, 1 million barrels a day. That's 200,000 barrels per day per year. But with the base work that was going on, plus these other fields that we brought on stream, we've done a tremendous amount to offset the base field decline. At this point in time, you know, the main fields aren't declining at that same rate. If we can have the kind of environment that brings back the kind of investment that we were seeing, I think, you know, there's a good chance that we can help offset that decline and, you know, hopefully turn the corner. Okay.
And just, you know, just briefly, I know we're running out of time. You know, we've talked about the big elephant fields, the legacy fields around the world, Prudhoe Bay being one of the top 10 in the world, having this parabolic curve. Where are we on that curve?
Prudhoe Bay in terms of?
And Kaparik in aggregate, I would say. Because we're
talking
looking
about
at
percent depletion?
On the parabolic curve, the flattening of the tail going out. I mean, some people have talked in the press that we're on the decline curve about as steep as a pencil and the world's going to end and everybody's going to be gone out of the state in 15 years, which is just flat, not true. So, you know, we're going to have this flattening tail. What amount should we be looking at in the flattening tail in production, in roughly in barrels and in time?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I got to ask you a few questions before I can try to answer your question. So is your question, if we stop drilling today, what would the production profile look like? Or if you have the continued investment that we have?
I would say the continued investment, status quo, the continued investment we have, basically we maintain the status quo. We don't change. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, it's a whole other discussion that has been going on about changing it, but we do recognize that there's a lot of money being spent to slow the decline curve. That doesn't go unnoticed.
Yeah. Senator Stedman, through the chair, at this point, sitting here today, I can't tell you at what point the existing investment would flatten out the decline, where you'd end up with kind of a static flat profile. It's probably someplace south of where we are right now. But I don't know the answer to your question.
That's something maybe we can ask our consultants to help us with, because it's something of interest.
You know, following up on Senator Stedman's, you know, this concept of development at a time in the past, you know, generally speaking, Alaskans have heard that it takes 7 to 10 years to bring, you know, a development online. And so the question is then asked, okay, the throughput decisions that we're at today were made as a result of decisions made in 2000, 2001, 2003, at a period of time that we had essentially had a 0% production tax rate, you know, so, and the decisions back then weren't made to increase the production over where we're at today. To the contrary, they were made so that we would be at the throughput that we're at today. What are your thoughts on that observation?
Mr. Chairman, since I was around in those time frames, do you remember the no decline after 99 mantra? We didn't succeed, but it was every bit our intention to try to make the investments to try to flatten out the decline, and that's still our intention. I mean, as an oil company, it is not our intention to ride production into the ground if we think we have opportunities. The problem we've got here in Alaska right now is that we have a handicap on to attract investment capital here to ramp up our investment. So I can't say that in that time frame people were thinking that we would have exactly the same production profile we have today. I think there were those who thought, you know, we can see a different we can see a way to try to material to stabilize production decline.
And Mr. Chairman, I may add, we did some work last year as part of testimony around our expenditures, capital expenditures in the earlier 2000 time frame versus today. And what we found by trying to normalize those costs to today's dollars, so you're comparing apples to apples, that we actually did spend significantly more on an average basis during that time frame than in the recent, the last 3 or 4 years. So there was a lot of activity going on, although the dollars on a nominal basis may not reflect it.
I guess just one follow-up question. You know, it was addressed with Mr. Bilbao just a little bit ago. You know, do you think Alaskans should expect to see 1 million barrels a day from state lands and conventional oil with the $5 billion investment over the next 10 years?
Mr. Chairman, you think you're saying 1 million barrels a day over the projects that have been identified?
You know, from state lands, yes.
I think, well, let me just start with the 1 million barrel a day goal. I think it's a great aspirational goal. I really hope we can get there. I think it will probably take some other types of technology than we see in the state right now. I certainly hope Great Bear is successful. I hope shale oil pans out. It might take something like that, plus probably some offshore help as well in the Beaufort and the Chukchi. State lands have potential. But, you know, I'm not sure exactly where we would see that upside that we, you know, in terms of getting to that million barrel a day goal.
Senator Willikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard that the $5 billion potential investment over 6 to 10 years may get us 200 million barrels of recoverable oil, and I'm just curious how many barrels per day that equates to. My rough guess is around 20,000 barrels a day. Is that about right?
Well, you know, it's always, Senator Willikowski through the chair, it's always a difficult thing to try to project the future on a lot of these projects because there's an awful lot of uncertainty out there. What I would like to do is come back to you and try to answer that question see if we can provide a little bit better estimate of that. I think it's considerably more than what you're talking about. But before I put that number on the table, I'd like to go back and talk with some of our experts and see if we can provide an answer around that.
Could I just ask what a typical 200 million barrel field generates in terms of barrels per day over how long a period of time?
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, there is no typical production rate. It depends upon reservoir quality, depends upon the quality of the oil, depends upon the kind of completions that you use, depends upon the pressure of the reservoir. So there is no typical production rate.
Well, we certainly look forward to receiving this information. But Mr. Heinrich, Mr. Jepson, we very much appreciate your coming before the Senate Resources Committee today. And we've even gotten a little bit of overtime, so I do thank all the committee members for bearing with us. And again, thank you very much to ConocoPhillips. Thank you very much to BP. With that, Senate Resources for March 1, 2012 is adjourned.